The sun rises on Monday morning over a land of beautiful baseball. We are going to go through all the results of the wild weekend that was, talk big Bob Witt, tell you why you should chill out a little bit about the trade deadline, and of course, dive into the muck that is the National League Wildcard Jamboree. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that will never drop out on you. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we're running from our problems and all the way to first base.
Good morning, Jake. It is Monday. It was an interesting weekend for your dear friend Jordan as we are in round three of the novel coronavirus. COVID's still a thing, friends, just so you guys know.
You're in the ALCS of COVID.
I am doing okay. I'm not doing awesome, so Jake will probably be doing more talking than I will. But the good news about being bedridden for the last 48 hours is, boy, did I watch a lot of baseball. So I am excited to talk about the baseball that happened over the weekend. We have a handful of sweeps. We have a handful of near sweeps because none of these National League teams are actually any good. And then we have it's Monday. We got all of our weekend recap segments. So we're going to have a good time, and I'm going to try to get through this. This is going to put me in a better mood. We'll see if it actually makes me feel physically better.
Jordan had his flu game, and now Jordan has his flu game. I will take the bulk. I will do my best, and we will begin, as always, with read it and sweep. There were no opportunities over the weekend. I take that back. There were two, neither of which are still alive, both of the New York clubs, the Mets and the Yankees. Have four game wraparound sets that finished today. But the three sweeps, we'll say three, that happened over the weekend. Dodgers sweeping the Red Sox, Nats sweeping the Reds, and the Royals sweeping the White Sox, with the Twins taking 2 of 2 from Minnesota. For some reason, they didn't play on Friday. If someone can explain that to me, please do. But we will begin with the sexy one, the Dodgers against the Red Sox in the Connor Wong Bowl. These two teams linked forever in baseball history for two of like the most significant, largest trades of the 21st century. First, the Adrian Gonzalez massive salary dump. And then, of course, Mookie Betts heading west. And we got a very interesting, compelling, close series between two quality baseball teams. But the Dodgers outlast the Red Sox in all three of these games.
Yeah, I mean, these were some quality ball games. We have a late Freddie Freeman grand slam in the bottom of the eighth to take the win on Friday. We have a kind of, oh no, are we about to play 18 innings again game on Saturday, where the Dodgers eventually outlast the Red Sox. And then on Sunday, it's just kind of a bludgeoning the Dodgers. With Shohei Ohtani nearly hitting a ball out of the stadium, they kind of took care of business on that one. Evan Phillips having some struggles for the Dodgers. That's been a little bit strange. Kenley Jansen blew it on Saturday against Kike. But to your point, though, this is the Connor Wong Bowl, right? Mookie's not playing. Alex Verdugo's on the Yankees. And Jeter Downs is, I don't know where Jeter Downs is. So Connor Wong's there, though. He's hanging out. He is on the Red Sox having a nice season. And I'm sure that all of Dodger Stadium was taking note of his return. But this was a nice little statement series here for the Dodgers of Los Angeles. We talked before the break how they have been looking so underwhelming. I made the case that they are just very injured. They are about to get less injured as they are getting Clayton Kershaw and Tyler Glasnow back this week. So that's exciting. Yamamoto, a little bit less clear when he is returning, but they are getting healthier, and we are seeing a version of them where it's like, oh yeah, no, this is still the Dodgers.
And this is what I wanted to see. Some zip, some fizz. They were a flat soda for about a month and a half before the All-Star break. And when you are the Los Angeles Dodgers and you are this star-studded juggernaut of baseballing talent, you are expected, perhaps unfairly, to inspire more often than not, to create this idea for the fans and in your opponents that you will win the baseball game. That the end of the story at the end of the night is you in the win column. And you will get there somehow, some way. And I think at points before the break, the Dodgers didn't convey that type of energy. Whereas this past weekend was certainly that. And for so many times over the last 12 years during this run, that has been a regular season feeling for the Los Angeles Dodgers, right? It's like, oh, Will Smith is going to hit a double in the eighth. And then, right, like it builds towards that. These games on Friday and Saturday, just that swing that Freddie had is the type of swing where if we look back on it, it's like that was a game-changing season.
Sure.
Altering
yeah,
moment.
But I would also say that, like, you know, Freddie being awesome and Shohei being awesome, like that's, you're baking that in. But when they're getting big hits from Kike and Gavin Lux, whose OPSs are, you know, 600 or lower, now, you know, they kind of feeling themselves a little bit more because that's what has obviously been lacking over the first part of this season.
I would say for the Red Sox, very quickly, not a problem. They were in these first two games. They're a good team. They will beat worse teams as the season goes forward. I think they'll be in the mix. Losing all three in LA just kind of stinks, but I don't think the sky is falling here, if that makes sense. A couple other things I want to harp on. Gavin Stone, starting pitcher for the Dodgers, has been so spectacular this year, so solid. He has the second most innings on the team as a rookie, and he's just giving them a level of stability that they really need. You know, he's just a very interesting, you know, 25 years old. He's got a 125 ERA plus. He's started 18 games. He's taken the ball every single time through. Got a 3.19 ERA. He's been the most stable member of this rotation, just up there with Tyler Glass now. So he was outstanding on Friday. And then I want to give Kike Hernandez some shine on Saturday. This was on the day that he reached 10 years of service time against his former ball club. And he hits a game-tying home run in the ninth and another game-tying hit in extra innings. For a player like that who, you know, he is entertainment no matter what, that's a good little storyline.
Yeah, and I would just say, I'm glad you mentioned Stone. You know, they've collected these pitching prospects, kind of developed them over the past few years, only to end up kind of bringing in these more expensive guys on top of them, whether it's Yamamoto, whether it's Glass now. I mean, even Paxton, you know, bring him in free agency. That it was never always obvious who they really believed in of that group. And ultimately, with all the injuries that they finally had to just say, and I remember being at Dodgers camp in spring training and kind of asking around, like, all right, like of this group, this large pile of guys who have succeeded in the upper minors, like who are we actually counting on? And Stone was the answer. And so they clearly have been right about that. I know Landon Knack's been pretty solid also, but you know, they've kind of emerged. It's pretty wild, right? I think all the excitement was around Bobby Miller, and he's in AAA right now. So credit to Gavin Stone. He's been a huge deal for them. And then we have to mention Kershaw, right? I mean, I got to be honest, I feel like this is faster than I kind of expected. It seemed like the rehab has gone pretty well. He's already made a few minor league appearances. But I'm going to keep my expectations pretty low for what Kershaw is going to be. And I think, too, that like it's like they also like need him right now. Right. I think there's maybe a version where he takes a little bit more time to come back if their whole rotation was pitching well and healthy. But right now they need starters, and he's clearly at least ready to give it a go. So I'm excited to see what it looks like. I'm a little nervous to see what it looks like, to be honest. But at least he's, you know, made some minor league appearances and gotten some, because if he had just gone out there with no minor league appearances and then we were just like, yeah, he's fine, I would have been very, very anxious about that. But I'm very curious to see what it looks like on Thursday.
Every additional Clayton Kershaw return every offseason when he's thinking about retirement, Texas Rangers, LA Dodgers, every time he comes back to the Dodgers, inevitably, it heightens the enjoyment of that experience, because the closer he gets to retirement, the more it dawns on me how special it is to watch him in Dodger Blue, in that stadium, in that environment, in that park where he's created so many memories over the last, you know, decade and a half. And so I will be locked in on Thursday watching this one. I'm very excited to see Clayton Kershaw back on the bump. Let's move on to another sweep. The Washington Nationals sweep the Cincinnati Reds in D.C. at the All-Star break. The Nationals were three games worse than the Reds, and it felt like they were trending away from the playoff picture, and the Reds were maybe not trending up, but were hanging right in there. And this three-game beatdown was not exactly the simplest outcome for people trying to understand the playoff picture. The Nats, who made a trade selling on Hunter Harvey to bring in prospects, then the team comes out and immediately wins three games in a row. On Friday, best Patrick Corbin start we've had in a long time. Highest game score he's had all season. Really nice weekend from Jacob Young, the Nats electric outfielder, four stolen bases over the three games. On Saturday, they end up winning against the Reds after Mackenzie Gore is like bad, like very blah, just goes two innings. Nats rally, get the W. And then on Sunday, James Wood, our lackadaisical king, our nonchalant overlord, going backside, go ahead, three-run bomb late in that one to give the Nats the sweep.
Yeah, man, that James Wood homer, left, going oppo on a pitch up and in, like, that is freak behavior in the best way possible. He really does make it look so easy. We've talked about that so much. And yeah, man, this is not what you're looking for with the Reds. Remember, they already had that disappointing stretch going into the break where they had the 10 games against bad teams, and I believe they went 5-5 over that stretch. And you looked at the three games against the Nats, who had started to sell, and you said, okay, well, that's another three games that you could feel a little bit better about. And yeah, it's just not what we want for Cincinnati. And now they're in a situation where they're heading to Atlanta and Tampa Bay over the next two series, kind of leading up to the trade deadlines. They're going to have some difficult decisions to make. Reds and Nationals now have the same record of 47-53, four games out of the wild card. The Reds are still at a plus 31 run differential, which is better than a lot of these teams. Nats still at minus 31. I still very much expect the Nationals to sell, but they've been pretty open about that. So I wouldn't expect that to change. Cincinnati's a little bit more of a different one. I think the most extreme move that they could really take from a selling perspective would probably be to trade Frankie Montas. Now, he hasn't been very good, but that's at least one that would very much signal like, yeah, this is not happening this year. And then Jonathan India too, right? That would be another one. He's been playing incredibly well, but I would be surprised. I think they're going to end up just kind of staying steady, which is disappointing. It's really definitely frustrating kind of what's happened with the Reds. Maybe they could turn around and play well in Atlanta and Tampa Bay, but they're probably looking towards going in the other direction. And I still expect the Nats to as well.
The one more thing on this, James Wood, just evaluating how he's been since he got called up. The two most important things on the good side that we've seen from Wood are he's not chasing. And we knew that was going to be the case. He's walking a lot, which goes in with that. And he's hitting the ball really freaking hard. Now, the problem, in quotes, he's 10 years old and he's been in the big leagues for 72 plate appearances. The problem so far is that he's whiffing on pitches inside the strike zone, right? And so that is the type of thing that he's going to have to work on over time and was a legitimate concern with him before this season, right? Just because his arms, his limbs are so long, his levers are so long, it's hard for him to be short to the baseball. And we didn't know how that swing was going to work against elite level competition, big league stuff until he got there. And so now it's the period where he needs to make that adjustment back. All that being said, he's been about a league average hitter in his first 72 plate appearances in the major leagues, providing, you know, value on the bases and a lot of on base percentage goodies. And so, yeah, James Wood, fine. Wouldn't worry. Wouldn't panic. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say he's always shown us, I mean, even back to high school, like he'll have some struggles and then he'll figure it out. So obviously it's not that easy to do that at the major league level, but I think he's tracking just fine. Obviously the ground ball rate is also a little high, but he's certainly hitting the ball hard. And I think that once those start going in the air and those swings that we saw on Sunday are so singular, there's so few people that can do that. It's a reminder of why he's there in the first place. So he's fun.
Judge and Otani are like that, and O'Neill Cruz is another one, just like that. opposite field. We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah. No, you don't, you worry. Brewers Twins, they only played two games, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. The Brewers took both of those. Two things I'd like to hit on here. One, Jackson Churio, who signed that big extension over the winter and debuted in the major leagues as a 20-year-old, one of the top prospects in baseball, Venezuelan outfielder, and understandably struggled in the early going, kind of held water and didn't exactly show on a consistent basis why we held him, all of us held him in such high regard. Over the last month and a half, since June 1st, he has really turned things around. 867 OPS in that span, highlighting the talent that he has. He's still 20 years old and 133 days. This is a baby. This person cannot buy a gin and tonic on by himself, okay? And so to see him start to turn the corner is really encouraging because, yes, the Brewers were so good over the first half of the season. They need a couple other things to go right to keep this lead because there were some things going on with them that are, in my opinion, a little unsustainable. So Jackson Churio developing into a real difference maker is a huge thing for them. He had three hits in the game on Saturday and then homered in the game on Sunday. If he can be like an impact difference maker, we might look back and say, oh, he would be a second half all-star if we did the November all-star game.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just think how it relates to Milwaukee. And I remember we talked last week about, I kind of made the parallels with Cleveland and Milwaukee. And I stand by a lot of those, but I do think that Milwaukee's offense, like this would be a huge difference maker if Jackson Churio was playing like an actual, you know, rookie of the year candidate that I think a lot of people were hoping that they would see from him. But yeah, he's born in 2004. So let's be a little bit patient here and let's see what he's capable of. Because, yeah, I think, you know, maybe especially when you start to have some regression from Joey Ortiz and Bryce Terang, right? I know Reese has struggled a lot, you know. This is a good way to balance that out. If you have him trending in the right direction, a lot of those guys were showing up while Churio was struggling. Now Churio starts popping off as those guys kind of come back to earth. That puts them in a pretty good spot.
Twins, always tough to lose your big rival up there. However, just want to alert you to Byron Buxton's 996 OPS since June 1st. Okay.
That's two news
more
to me.
Homers yesterday.
I genuinely did not realize that. I did not realize how well he'd been hitting.
Pretty regularly as well. Like we have seen the Byron, the Buxton over the last 6 weeks.
Yeah. That is a good one. Yeah. No, I truly did not know. I guess we're still waiting. Right, we're still waiting for Royce Lewis to come back again. And Correa is now hurt. So like they're gonna need him to start showing up like that if their offense is gonna kinda sustain. Miranda now also on the IL. So those were two very, very good games. I enjoy watching both those teams play.
But our player of the weekend, and this folds into Read It and Sweep, is Big Bob Jr. Bobby Witt. The shortstop for the Kansas City Royals, our player of the weekend, going 9-for-11 with a home run. 9-for-11 over the weekend. It seemed like he took the frustration of going 0-for-1 in the All-Star game to heart and really locked in this series against the White Sox that the Royals took all three of.
Yeah. Bobby Witt, again, when you can, it's nice to have the White Sox on the schedule coming out of the break, but this was nice for the whole Royals team to just come out and really take care of business. We get Seth Lugo's first career complete game. We get, as you mentioned, we get three hit games from Big Bob Witt, and yeah, this is what you have to do. And now with them sweeping the White Sox, they end up passing Boston as Boston gets swept. Now Kansas City once again occupying that third wild card spot in the American League. But yeah, I'm curious, was that the last time the Royals get to play the White Sox this year? Oh no, I guess they get them one more time in a couple weeks. So you gotta, again, we gotta take advantage of those. So yeah, 9-1 this season against the White Sox. They will try to make that 12-1 in a couple of weeks. But yeah, this was much needed. Royals have been unbelievable at home this year, one of the best home teams in baseball. I believe they do. They have the best home record in baseball. I think they are one of their third best home record in baseball behind Cleveland and Philadelphia. So, but yeah, Bob Witt's tough to top 9 hits in a weekend. So he is definitely our player of the weekend.
And I would like to say to all the listeners out there, Bobby Witt Jr., we have Bobbies. We've discussed this. We need Bob. Okay. I think we got to start calling Bobby Witt Jr. Bob. His teammates call him Bob. We don't have a big league Bob. I would love a jersey with a 7 on the back in the Royals blue that just says Bob. The idea that he is Bob and his dad is Bobby is such a great kind of inversion of our norms of what we expect from fathers and sons. And I think actually says that, like, you know, who the real father is in this relationship is Bob Witt Jr., the younger one who's better, right? Not to say that Big Bob had a bad career, but just saying, let's Bob it up. You know, who says no? Jake and Jordan.
Yeah, it would be interesting if he, again, we talked recently about the minor leaguer Bobby Seymour changing to official Bob on the roster. Would Bob Witt Jr. ever do this? I like this too. We had some discourse about people calling him Junior and how whether that is something that we should be bringing back. But I think calling him Bob is really, I think, the way to go. So yeah, 9 for 11 is a pretty nice setup here. Who do the Royals have next? So they have the D-backs and the Cubs coming in. This is a good transition to our NL jamboree here before we take a break. D-backs and Cubs coming to Kansas City, and then they got the White Sox on the road after that. So Royals are still going to be in it. I expect them to be buyers still. We saw them traded for Hunter Harvey. I expect them to keep pushing forward here as the deadline approaches.
Let's take a quick break, and when we return, we will dive deep into the NL muck and try and sift through which of these teams is good and which of these teams are bad. The answer, none of them. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. The National League is a mystery so deep and complicated that not even Nancy Drew, crossed over with the Hardy Boys, could solve it. Those were the real Pulitzer Prize winning books. We will start at the top of the heap, where the St. Louis Cardinals and the Atlanta Braves faced off this weekend, with the Cards taking 2 of 3 from Atlanta. Friday's game postponed. They split the doubleheader on Saturday, and the Cardinals win on Sunday. The important thing, though, here is injuries. Ozzie Albies fractures his wrist on a freak play that involved a slide at second base, where he was if I said Ozzie Albies injures hand, slide second base, you think he's on offense. Well, no. A helmet, I believe by Michael Ciani, clanged into Ozzie's hand, fractured his wrist. He's going to be out for about 8 weeks. Nacho Alvarez being called up, one of their top prospects. Tell me about Nacho Alvarez.
Yeah, so there's some substantial reporting that Nacho Alvarez is coming up. We also got news this morning that the Braves are signing Whit Merrifield, who is seemingly going to also be part of the backfilling of the Aussie injury.
Whit Merrifield, who was just on the Phillies, feels like they, you know, this is a great move from the Braves. You sign this guy, you just got a free spy. Easy. When these two teams play in the NLDS, they're just going to send Whit back there undercover, ask him to copy and paste all the secrets and bring it back to the Braves clubhouse.
I will say Whit Merrifield, who, you know, had a 572 OPS with the Braves or with the Phillies before he got just like outright released. This does set up for, you know, not that we need more juice for this Phillies break. This is an unexpected addition to the spice in the Braves Phillies rivalry is Whit Merrifield getting random clutch hits or like pinch running and stealing a bag, you know, against Real Muto. It's at some point later in the season. So, but let's talk about Nacho Alvarez, because he's a lot more interesting. This is a guy who was drafted just 2 years ago, and just to get a sense of how like completely out of nowhere this guy was. I mean, he was a 5th round pick out of a California junior college. And he was not, you know, I have my crazy draft spreadsheet that, you know, has the names of 90% of the players that get drafted. He was not on my sheet on draft day. I went back and checked that. I think he was the earliest pick that year that was not on my sheet. And the reason I bring that up is just like, this is a hell of a scout, man. Whoever the area, I wish I knew, whoever the area scout is that was like, we got to take this California junior college kid in the fifth round and give him $500,000 when like basically nobody knew who he was. And for him to race through the minors and be one of their best hitting prospects. I know they don't have a lot of good hitting prospects. Just a really impressive kind of bat to ball, plate discipline, can play shortstop. That's really impressive that they could identify him as someone that could hit this well this quickly for someone that was competing at the junior college level. That's we're just seeing fewer and fewer guys that can junior college hitters that are being drafted high nowadays. And for him to kind of be able to do that is so impressive. So he gets to the big leagues already and we'll see how much he actually plays. It's not that it's going to be a lot of power, but if he can even be competent for them, that's a huge win for their scouting and player development.
Also set to be the first MLB Nacho.
Yes, Ignacio, the real name, but I'm glad he's been going. At some point, again, we talk about the he was Ignacio Alvarez at some point when he first signed, and now it's his full Nacho. So we'd love to see it.
There have been Nachos at the ballpark for a long time, and now there really will be Nachos at the ballpark for a long time. Max Fried also going on the aisle for the Braves. Doesn't seem too serious. It'll be brief, but at the point now the Braves are at, like, missing any important player for any stretch is really tough for them. Every time that they miss an opportunity to gain ground on the Phillies, it just feels more and more likely that Philadelphia is going to run away with this. The lead right now is 8.5 games, but the Braves do sit pretty atop the wild card heap. They are still, even after losing this series to the Cardinals, 2.5 games up on them. In the third wild card spot right now, the New York Mets, who lost 2 of 3 over the weekend to the Miami Marlins. There's one more game for them. Today on Monday, I'm kind of interested to see the Mets when they get home this week. They'll be playing the Yankees on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I will be at those games. And then the Braves are coming into town to play the Mets. So a couple interesting series here coming up for the Queens Ball Club. Below the Mets on percentage points with one more win and one more loss is the Arizona Diamondbacks, who took 2 out of 3 from the Cubs, as you mentioned. Tied with them with one more win and one more loss is the San Diego Padres, who are 52-50. Padres took 2 out of 3 from the Guardians over the weekend.
Yeah, I was, before I fell ill, I was there on Friday, kind of checking in on both the Gardos and the Padres of San Diego. The main thing to know about the Padres right now is Dylan Cease is on one. He had an incredible start against the Braves right before the break. Carries that momentum into the second half here. Or not really the second half, because the Padres have already played 100 games. The second 40% for the Padres. But he's been amazing. I mean, we haven't really talked about him much. He's leading the league in strikeouts. Like, I know his ERA is 3.76, but the walks are down. He's throwing more strikes than he has really at any point in his career. And I think Dylan Cease deserves more attention. And Michael King also has been outstanding for them. So that's another one. Again, so much turnover on that roster, and they're dealing with some injuries also. But I feel good about the Padres. I feel like them responding to after looking terrible on Friday and kind of winning those next two games in Cleveland, which, again, as we mentioned, they have the best home record in baseball. Really impressive showing from San Diego.
I don't feel good about anything. I'm happy that you feel good about the Padres. I don't believe any of these teams are good. The only thing I feel good about is the new comforter I just got off my wedding registry. Very excited to check that out. Yeah, we love that. One last National League wildcard series here that I want to zoom in on. And I want to use it as our first time for everything segment that we've been doing. I've never seen this before. Rowdy Tellez with 3 sac flies in a single game. First player in MLB to do that since 2008. And the first Pittsburgh Pirate to have 3 sac flies in a game since ever. Think about that. Think about how long the Puckos have existed. Rowdy Tellez, 3 sacks, 1 evening, no worries. This was on Friday night, by the way.
Yeah. sack flies are one of the kind of stranger statistics. I mean, on its surface, it's not that complicated, but like, I remember the fun fact that Joey Gallo did not have a single sack fly for the first 4 years of his career, which again seems impossible for someone that puts the ball in the air that much. Yeah, I mean, he had in 2017, 2018, he had 81 home runs and zero sack flies. So it's very, now maybe that makes some sense. It's like, oh yeah, because Joey Gallo, whenever he was trying to hit a sack fly, he would screw up and accidentally hit a home run. That's possible, right? But yeah, sack flies are sneaky weird. And you can end up with fun facts like this, where 3-1 game doesn't seem that wild, but indeed it is. However, while that is a good first time for everything, the only thing I want to talk about here in the poop bowl is
explain what that is, please. You can't just say the words poop bowl on our podcast and not explain what that is.
I feel like that's something that like we've kind of earned. I think I should be able to say poop bowl and just keep moving forward.
Do you think your mom and my mom, who both listen to the show, understood what you just said when you said poop bowl? Do you really think
I'm gonna filibuster for another 10 seconds and let our lovely mothers think about why it is called the poop bowl. I will explain. Poop is a funny word. I don't have to explain. Yeah, do I have to explain what poop
that
is?
I know what poop is, and I know that it's funny.
I wasn't sure how far back you needed me to go.
Yeah.
So once we establish that, then you understand that the Pirates and the Phillies from Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, a lot of P's in there, which means that their logos, of course, have the letter P. Now, fortunately, thanks to the, I believe it is only on the Phillies broadcast, where the chyron that shows the score, which oftentimes has the logos of the teams next to the score. Fortunately for us, for all of us, the P's are sandwiching the two zeros at the start of a game. Now, I believe in this series, they scored pretty early in these games, so the poop didn't last very long. I remember that earlier this season, the first edition of this season, we had a 0-0 game going to like the sixth or seventh inning, and it was like, wow, this poop's lasting a while. But this time, we had a good amount of scoring in this one, and the Pirates feeling good. This is a series where Paul Skenes wasn't even starting, as he is, you know, taking some extra rest after all of his, you know, festivities at All-Star Week Friday. The Pirates win an absolutely wild one, 8-7. They win 4-1 on Saturday, but then Sunday the Phillies are like, hey guys, let's get it together here. Phillies win 6-0. But the only thing I want to say about this before we take a break, the home run that O'Neill Cruz hit, I believe it was on Saturday, if I am correct on that one. One of the more aesthetically shocking home runs I think I've ever really seen. Now, O'Neill Cruz has had his fair share of these, but something about it, again, off of Strom, right? All-star Matt Strom, left. You don't really see, it's very difficult to go oppo in Pittsburgh for left-handers. Like, that, it is not an easy park to do that. But just the trajectory of this ball was breathtaking. It was a shocking home run, and I just had to watch it many times over. And the Pittsburgh broadcast, the Pittsburgh call really, really kind of did it justice, just the shock of what had just occurred. And those are the ones that I think are even more impressive than when he, you know, yanks one into the Allegheny. But O'Neill, man, he's been playing incredibly well lately, and that's another huge deal for the Pirates offense.
The ball flight was so golf, and you and I don't golf or watch golf or really think about golf. And I think that if we did do golf, this ball would almost be less and more shocking, because the type of trajectory that this home run from Cruz takes is very golf. And for a player to do that with a baseball bat is downright remarkable.
And
go ahead.
And this is on Friday. He hit one 120 off the center field wall. Very similar, more to dead center off of Pache. And that one was also shocking to watch because, like, you just don't see the ball get to the center field wall that fast. We've seen when O'Neill's hit him 120 before, which he's done multiple times, he's usually pulling them off the wall and right. This one was just, like, so low. And, like, Pache takes this route where he's, like, he's like, again, Pache, great center fielder. He's taken those reads a million times. And he was like, whoa, I'm sorry. Where did that ball just go? Like, it was just zoomed past his head in a blink.
You can't really practice trying to track down a 2-iron zipping towards your dome piece at 120 miles an hour. That's not really in the owner's manual for playing center field. That is also a first time for everything. So good job in the poop series. A lot of unique things going on there. Two more segments. Jordan Schusterman, time to boot up everybody's favorite. Sorry for your mentions. The Seattle Mariners are a disaster piece. They were 10 games up on June 18th. They are now tied atop the American League West with the Houston Astros. After the Astros took 2 out of 3 games in Seattle, the Mariners salvaging the finale in what is a July must win from the vibes perspective. That being said, speaking of vibes, Ty France, who was an all-star for these Seattle Mariners 2 years ago, placed on waivers. This was shocking to me. For you, as someone who does watch a lot more of this team than I do, can you give me a 30-second explanation of how we got to this point with Ty France, that he goes from an all-star to placed on waivers in 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, his profile was always very delicate. I think after the struggles he had last year relative to the year before, there was reasons to wonder, you know, what direction this was going in. But a lot of the underlying data last year said that, like, okay, he actually doesn't have to change that much. But when you're a right-handed hitting first baseman who brings zero, if not negative value defensively and on the bases, you better be hitting. And even on this Mariners team where nobody's been hitting, that specific spot to not be hitting is not tenable. And most notably, when they feel like they have an internal option in Tyler Locklear, it seems like they might maybe also bring up Jason Vossler. That's obviously does not make anyone feel awesome. But it feels like they believe in Tyler Locklear. And I think that France has just been, he's just been so bad for 2 months, and they clearly do not see him getting out of this anytime soon. And the Mariners are at least acknowledging some level of sense of urgency. There are still a lot of problems on this roster that they're going to try and address over the next couple months, or next couple weeks, I should say, right ahead of the deadline. But it sucks, right? Ty France, his kind of come up was really fun. A guy who was just a late bloomer that no one ever really thought, like, oh, could this guy really actually hit at the major league level? And he did it, man. He was awesome for a couple of years there. And it just really fell off hard. And I think he was heading towards a non-tender anyway. And now that they're clearly showing a level of urgency that expresses a little bit more of this is not something we can keep going forward with. And it sucks because everybody loves Ty France, the person and the teammate, but it was not happening for him, and I don't think they saw that it was going to change anytime soon.
The Seattle Mariners offense is just abysmal, and France is the casualty of it. The sorry for your mentions I'm going to do is the score graphic on Saturday night after the Mariners lost those two games on Friday and Saturday. They lose on Saturday 3-0, not a run is scored, and an account at We Love Ty France wrote, make some moves or consider the season over. At We Love Ty France, maybe be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because that was tweeted before they put Ty France on waivers.
They were like, all right, we'll make some moves. And they're like, oh, who just said this to us? Oh, Ty France. Oh, Ty France has a 500 OPS over the last 2 months. Yeah, okay, we'll make that move.
Someone says DFA the entire team. Someone else says
that I would not recommend. That would not help. That we can't be DFAing the whole team. That would do, I think, more harm than good at this point.
All right. Someone thinks he's a GM. Someone else says DFA the ownership.
That's an interesting one. That is an interesting one. Would ownership clear waivers? Probably. I don't know if other teams are looking for John Stan to come in. Maybe. I don't know. Actually, maybe Tampa Bay or like Oakland would be like, oh, yeah, we'll claim John Stanton. Are you kidding me? John Stanton over John Fisher all day long.
I like the idea that Jerry DePoto calls his boss and is like, hey, we got to talk. We're going to go ahead and DFA. You know, you've done a lot of things for this club, but it's just not working out. One person says, glad football is soon. Very typical. Makes a lot of sense. You see that one a lot. Brian says, hope this isn't a trend, which is so funny because obviously he knows it is. Someone says, the Seattle Mariners offense is the worst of any contending team I've ever seen. Julio Rodriguez should be demoted. Should be demoted. Yeah. That's kind of a complicated process.
That was the same. I believe that is the game that Julio hit a home run, go ahead home run, that they eventually squandered the lead later. So
no, that was on Friday night. That was on Friday night. I believe this is after they were shut out on Saturday night. Both kind of backbreaking losses. And the last thing I'll say here, one person writes, it really is sad because live sports are supposed to be thrilling with the endings always in doubt. But watching that game last night was like watching a movie you have seen many times. I knew the outcome before it happened.
No, the shutout was on Friday. I suffered through that. I'm pretty sure the shutout was Friday. Saturday was Ryan Stanek allowing the go-ahead home run of the seventh. I will also say Yordan Alvarez hitting for the cycle on Sunday. His first cycle of his career was nice. It was good. I enjoy Yordan Alvarez. Like I've said this before, he is a one hell of a nemesis for Seattle, and that extends back obviously a while now. But he's pretty difficult to dislike. He is truly a gem of a hitter, and especially in games like that where it's like, all right, hit for the cycle and the Mariners win. I mean, that seems impossible, but you'll take that. The home run he hit, the triple. I know Julio, by the way, hopefully not seriously injured. Seems like they avoided that being worse when he had a bit of an ankle scare there, chasing after Yordan's triple. So we'll see. Because if Julio's out for a while, now we're really in a dark place. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Demote him to the injured list. One phenomenal moment from the series on Saturday night was Astros right fielder Trey Cabbage robbing Julio Rodriguez of extra bases and then throwing up Julio's signature no fly zone hand sign. For those of you who don't know, Julio, whenever he makes a great play in center field, kind of puts his hands, his arms, his forearms across one another, kind of like a DMX. It's the same as like the DMX sign, and kind of bangs his arms together. And then all the fans in the outfield kind of do the same thing. And when the vibes are good in Seattle, it's a delightful scene at T-Mobile Park. That's not the case now. Trey Cabbage makes a great play, robs Julio, and hits Julio with a very low-key no-fly zone thing. And Julio laughs and tips his cap. Good job, everyone. This is great. There are players who are in Julio. I understand he's been struggling and fans aren't exactly enthused with him right now, maybe. But at the end of the day, like, great. That's the point. That's the point of a superstar, right? That's playing the game in the way that you and I really love and enjoy. And that moment kind of stuck out for me and gave me a warm, fuzzy feeling. Speaking of warm, fuzzy feelings, it was Hall of Fame induction weekend. Admittedly, I have not watched any of these speeches yet. I was busy, but Adrian Beltre, Todd Helton, Joe Mauer, Jim Leland, all inducted into Cooperstown. I'm going to watch these on 1.5 speed while I ride my bike today. You know, really, some people listen to hype music. I listen to Jim Leland's Hall of Fame speech while I'm in heart rate zone 4.
Yeah.
And I'm just built differently. I don't know what to tell you.
That should fire you up. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've obviously talked about this back when they were elected, but I guess that wasn't on this podcast from what I recall. So it's been a bit of a while since we talked about this. But yeah, I mean, all three of these guys mean a lot to a lot of people. Obviously that's the case for a bit. And it's always cool. I mean, my favorite part is to see who takes the trip, you know, when they pan to the crowd and they show who's up there. I always enjoy that. So, and it is always interesting, like who gets the shout outs in the speeches. Which was cool, especially for Beltre. That's the one I did see. But yeah, it's good. Those are all players that we enjoy. And also, by the way, like this is the other thing too, is it's like these are Hall of Famers that we very much like have long, extensive memories of watching, which is still a fresh experience for us, I would say, right? Still getting used to that. So that is weird and cool at the same time. So again, I'm not complaining that we're old or anything. I'm just saying it is a new feeling.
Happy to be old. Better to be old than dead. Speaking of dead, the Yankees offense, the New York Yankees took one of three over the weekend, is a funny way to say that. They have one more game today at the stadium against the Rays. And the Yankees' incompetence offensively against the Rays, I think, is so interesting. The league slash line since the start of 2020 is .245 batting average, .316 on base, .406 slug. Okay, so that is a .722 OPS. The Yankees slash line versus the Rays since the start of 2020 is .209, .283, .356. That is a slash line under .650. Now, the Yankees have been like a good offensive team basically down in, for a lot of that stretch. They have employed Aaron Judge for the entirety of that stretch. And yet, it does not matter. They just cannot seem to hit against the Tampa Bay Rays, who exploded on Saturday with a barrage of runs. Randy Rosarena on fuego for Tampa right now. Look, it's a win-win for the Rays, obviously. If Randy keeps raking and they don't win games, they'll trade him and bring a haul back. And if they decide to stay in it, then Randy will stick around and keep raking. My favorite moment from the series was Aaron Boone getting ejected once again. It is his fifth ejection this year. Friend of the show, Laura Albanese, with some great Boone ejection stats. He is now averaging an ejection every 25.5 games. 25.5 games. That's basically once a month for the entirety of his managerial career. Okay. He is now third on the active list in ejections. He has managed 971 games and has 38 career ejections. He passed Bud Black in career ejections with this one yesterday. Bud Black has managed 2,493 career games. So he has managed 1,500 more games than Aaron Boone. Okay. And Boone passed him in ejections. He still has to catch Bob Melvin and Bruce Bochy. It'll take some time to do that. Bochy's at 84 career ejections in over 4,000 games. But Aaron Boone is the GOAT ratio ejectee. I mean, it has reached a point where umpires expect him to pop off. And I think it is worth a longer conversation that I don't want to have right now, to be honest, about a level. Entitlement's like the wrong word, but the Yankees expect to win every single game they play, as they should and as a lot of teams do. I understand that. But there's this superiority complex that kind of permeates a lot of what exists in the Bronx. And for Boone, it's like, I need to get that call. I'm the manager of the Yankees. And I think that the Yankees are no more slighted or screwed over by umpires than any other team. I would be shocked to find that to be the case. Maybe the numbers say that they are, but it is how Boone chooses to react to this. And I do think there's a time and place to get rung, to get your team going. But I think we've reached a point with Boone where it's becoming something of a detriment. It is both funny to watch every time it happens, but there's no way it's like a good thing. I can't imagine an umpire is sitting back there being like, oh, I'm going to give Aaron Boone's club a half ball off the plate because he yells at me every time I see him.
Right. That is a fair way to think about it. And I'm curious, I don't know this. Did he get ejected as a player very often? Like, I have no idea how to really look that up. Obviously, it's much harder to get ejected as a player. So that's, you know, so I'm assuming he was not ejected 38 times as a player. But it is definitely interesting. It's definitely entertaining for the rest of us, but it is probably at some point not ideal. However, the one over the weekend was particularly funny because of the video that you sent, which unintentionally Yankees beat writer Chris Kirschner tweeted this out. And I don't think Chris like meant to post this video for the reason that we're finding it funny, but I am very glad that he did. Basically, he posted a video of Aaron Boone arguing after he had been ejected. But because of the timing of the video is really what is so special, as Aaron Boone is strolling towards the home plate umpire as YMCA is blaring over the Yankee Stadium speakers it almost looks like a corded. I mean, again, it's so funny that it almost looks fake, but I think that this is just a wonderful moment of serendipity where Aaron Boone's going to get his money's worth, and we're kind of getting hyped to YMCA.
You know what I have to say to Aaron Boone? Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, young man, pick yourself off the ground. I said, young man, because you're in really, I guess, the same town. Yeah, Aaron Boone, ejection king. Let's finish up here, Jordan. Turbo mode. Let's put this into speed. We got four more series we haven't talked about yet. The A's taking 2 out of 3 from the Angels. Oakland is just such a bizarre bad team where, in my mind, they make a lot of contact and don't hit for any power, but in reality, they're the absolute opposite of that. This team hits freaking dingers and stinks anyway.
Yeah, the A's, do you know where they rank in home runs?
My guess would be fourth.
Fourth. They are indeed fourth behind only Baltimore, the Yankees, and the Dodgers. The A's have 127 home runs. Do you know who's last and how few it is?
My guess would be either the Nationals or the Marlins are last.
Those are the bottom two. The Nationals are 29th with 84. The Marlins are 30th with 81. They are almost half as many home runs as the Orioles of Baltimore. But yeah, man, I mean, Rooker is obviously the one getting a lot of the attention. Shea Langeliers has 18 home runs. Bladé and Geloff have 12. But yeah, Rooker's up to 22. So yeah, man, the A's kind of rake. And Miguel Andujar, by the way, he had 8 hits over the weekend. So he was coming for big Bob Witt's title.
I could have given you such good odds that the Braves would have more home runs than the Oakland A's this season, and we might end up with that not being the case, as the Braves are currently at 115 homers and Oakland is at 127. Matt Olson, second on the Braves in homers, tied for second with just 13. It's been a bizarre season in Atlanta. Three more series to touch on here. Orioles take 2 out of 3 from Texas, almost pull off the sweep, losing by one run on Sunday. The O's All-Stars, who I asked, Jordan, they did stick around in Texas. All 5 of them who were there for the All-Star festivities just never left. And took it to the Rangers over the weekend. Anthony Santander with 3 home runs. He has just been the best power hitter in baseball, basically over the last 2 months, right up there with Aaron Judge. The Orioles still need pitching help, but it is good to see them continue to bury the Rangers a little bit deeper, the team that knocked them out of the playoffs. The Rangers are 7.5 game back in the wild card, and every indication I'm getting, Jordan, is that this is a team that is going to sell where these pieces go and for what remains one of the biggest stories of the deadline. Two more CRI to take here. The Rockies take 2 out of 3 from the San Francisco Giants. Woot, woot, Ryan McMahon, 6-walk weekend, baby. Now that's why you buy a ticket and you go to the yard. Friend of ours from high school who now lives in Denver sent us a picture and said, I understand what you guys are talking about. This Coors Field thing is pretty sweet. And I said, you are the exact demographic of person that the Colorado Rockies are trying to sell to. You don't have an iota who any of the players on the Rockies are, especially while Chris Bryant is down rehabbing in the minor leagues. But yet you are having a nice time at the yard in a beautiful town with good beer and nice weather. And there's nothing wrong with that, except if you want to watch the Rockies win baseball games.
Yeah. Shouts out to Hayden Birdsong as the Giants.
He's nails. That dude rules.
As the Giants salvage a game on Sunday, thanks to Hayden Birdsong. Now, the box score is impressive, right? 6 innings, 12 strikeouts, 2 walks, 2 hits, 27 swings and misses, which I believe I saw a note from Sarah Langs was the most by a rookie in the pitch tracking era, which is absolutely sensational. And to do that in Coors Field, throwing more breaking balls than fastballs is kind of shocking. So Hayden Birdsong, I mean, if I'm the Rockies, I'm just offering the farm for Hayden Birdsong. Say, hey, man, if you could do that here, maybe we're not very good, but that was really impressive. So shouts out to him.
And the last series was the Detroit Tigers taking 2 out of 3 from the Toronto Blue Jays. Just really hammering down that gap of where the bad teams begin. Blue Jays 9.5 out. Detroit only 6 out, but I don't think they'll go for it at the deadline. The big development in this one, I mean, we got a home run from Mark Canna, who, if he can turn it on a little bit, proves to be a pretty valuable piece. If you are looking for the 2024 Steve Pierce, I think it's going to smell quite a bit like Mark Canna.
The other thing I want to mention about this one is George Springer has been unbelievable for the last month. Now, I don't really know. I mean, it seems, I doubt they would be able to trade him because he's got like 75 million or like 50 million left over the next two seasons. But I mean, he looks incredible right now. And again, we talked about with Chris Bassitt last week, if the Blue Jays were willing to eat some of that money, if they would be able to deal him, that's another one that I would maybe keep an eye on. I mean, it seems a little extreme, but he's really looked not just better. I mean, obviously, he's been one of the best hitters in baseball over the last month. So Springer's another guy I'm kind of watching if the Blue Jays really try to go super extreme with this sell-off.
One more point before we leave. It is deadline season. We will talk about it even more on our Wednesday episode. You know, I'm seeing a lot of nuggets, a lot of rumors come through the wire. And I just want to say, teams discussing players is not news, my friends. It is not news. Teams are discussing players with one another basically all the time. If we get reaching stages, if they're talking about certain packages going back, if we get more buzz and more fuzz, we will discuss it as it comes. But, you know, Orioles, Dodgers have discussed Tarik Skubal with Tigers. Yeah, like I have discussed winning the lottery with Jordan Schusterman, right? We are not at a point where it has reached a threshold to really break things down. Maybe we'll dig into it a little bit more on Wednesday. That's just kind of how I feel about it. Don't get tricked by fake accounts on this deadline season. George Schusterman, thank you for doing a podcast with me. I hope you heal up very soon. Thank you to Hillary Georgie for producing this bad boy. And I want to wish everybody an absolutely beautiful Monday.